ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. Now, if you live in the top end, I wonder if your frangipani tree or your pawpaw plant has been getting attacked of late. On the Country Hour today, we go on the hunt for the exotic pest that is causing the damage.
People will notice it. It will get onto the plants, and to begin with, you'll get quite a large infestation.
Also today, you'll meet an award-winning biosecurity sniffer dog. And before 1:30, a catch-up with one of this week's finalists in the NT's Rural Women's Award. A busy Country Hour today. Hope you can stick around. We're broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC, streaming online, and g'day there if you have tuned in via the podcast. Now, our guest on the Country Hour today is the NT's independent water controller, Andrew Johnson, who is almost 12 months in this role. And during Andrew's first year, he has seen the rollout of new water plans, he's seen changes to the NT's Water Act, and he's told the Country Hour that he's got an eye on unused water in the Katherine region. I caught up with Andrew to talk all things H2O and to find out what's been keeping the water controller busy.
Thanks, Matt. Certainly it's been an interesting journey coming up to speed with the legislation, the policies, procedures that are used by the government to manage water resources across the territory. I suppose from my perspective, what I've observed with the water allocation plans in a number of areas, on paper, those resources are over-allocated. What we're actually seeing is that, in fact, water use is well below what's been allocated.
Yeah, so for example, the Katherine Tyndall Limestone Aquifer. Tell us the story there and what you're seeing.
So what we're seeing there is you've got the estimated sustainable yield, but the allocations that have been made to that resource are greater than the estimated sustainable yield.
Which makes for a terrible headline, over-allocated.
Yep, and I've listened to a few media outputs which have suggested the Territory has a number of resources that are over-allocated. And on paper, that's correct. But when you actually look at utilisation of that resource, it's a very different story. So as you said, the Katherine Tyndall resource, you're only using 33% of the water that's been allocated. And as a consequence, what the department and as a consequence me have been trying to do is implement a water recovery process. So we've contacted all water users in the Katherine Tyndall catchment area.
There's been meeting with growers.
There's been meetings with growers. There's been meeting with the broader community. I've been down for a meeting with Aboriginal communities. And there's a lot of angst in terms of that resource. But when you're looking at, if you like, people sitting on nearly 70% of the resource and not using it, that's a lot of economic development in a key development region for the Territory. So we've contacted, or the department's contacted, all of the licence holders in the region. As you said, they've had public meetings, and we've been looking at the process of water recovery. And so particularly, you know, there are about 10 licences that represent the majority of water allocated. And we've been looking at those in detail. We haven't missed any of the others, but we're also focused on those. And looking to say, okay, what is your water requirement? What's your future development strategy? And then trying to identify how much water with a buffer, how much water you're going to need into the future.
Have you got a target in mind on how much water you would like to see reclaimed in that Katherine region?
No target specific, but what we would like to be able to achieve are two things. One is providing water for the Aboriginal Water Reserve, so that at the moment there's almost insignificant amount, and as well as then being able to take the water isn't being used and then reallocating it or making it available.
So that if a young couple in the Katherine region wanted to get a water extraction licence to grow whatever, there would then be an opportunity.
That's correct. Whereas at the moment, if they put in an application because it's overallocated, they don't even get considered.
During your time as water controller, all water licences in the Northern Territory are now treated as high security licences. Can you explain to our audience why that's been done?
So previously, all licences had several conditions. Historically, there's been on different licences either high security, medium or low security. What that meant is when we have less than 100% allocation, the low security falls off the bottom. What we're seeing again is trying to look at what is the equity of access, because what you'll then have is potentially some people with high security just sitting on water, whereas the low security people are desperate for water. So what we're doing is removing the three tiers and replacing it with just a standard tier. So if we have less than 100% allocation, the department will then go in and talk to users and identify what is their current water use and what is their water requirements for the rest of the year, and will then make decisions on that basis rather than trying to just say who's got a high or a low security and right, doesn't actually take into consideration water requirements for users.
Has much water been reclaimed? Like, I think for a long time it's just been called use it or lose it. Has much water been reclaimed back in the last 12 months?
We've really only just started that process.
Okay.
I can't, off the top of my head, I can't tell you how much has been recovered. In a number of cases where we would like to recover water, people have identified that they do have future plans for use of the water. And so what I this happens when you come in for renewal. So what we've been looking at is that development plan really valid? And as a consequence, we'll give you a couple of years to actually prove that you're actually going to use it.
If you're tuning in, this is the Country Hour, and we're speaking to the Territory's independent water controller, Andrew Johnson, talking all things water, all things H2O with the water controller. A couple of questions from our audience, Andrew. First one is, the water allocation plan for Western Davenport has expired. What does that mean for current farmers and any future projects?
The implications for Western Davenport when you don't have a water allocation plan is if you apply for an application, I'll consider it on the basis of policies that apply to, in that case, to the arid zone, and we'll look at the available water and...
This is where old 80-20 rules start coming in. Is that right?
It's more... Yes, you're probably right. The 20% of the allocation of the resource, which if you look at the draft plan that was released, you would be wanting to, from a sustainability perspective, that would probably be, wouldn't be the way to go in terms of allocating water. But if I don't have...
There's no plan, that's what you have to do.
That's what I do.
What part of the Territory at the moment are you seeing the most demand for new water allocations?
There's a number of them in Darwin Rural, but that's because of the policies relating to the Darwin Rural, where previously people that were using water exempt, they need to apply.
Yeah, so that's sort of just farmers get in all their paperwork in order.
Paperwork in order.
What about further south? Is there demand coming from a new region?
There are some interest in Katherine, but again, because it's over-allocated, you're not going to get a resource. Mm-hmm. Potentially, I would think there's going to be some in Western Davenport, but again, I'm hoping that a water allocation plan will come through the system at some stage in the near future.
Yeah. From what I can tell, there's been no large applications come over your desk in the last 12 months.
Not in the last 12 months. Yeah. Most of the stuff I've been doing is renewals. There's been a couple of new licences, but that's about all.
Perhaps finally, a big part of you coming into this role is that you did replace Joe Townsend, who had been the water controller for a few years, while also being the chief executive of the Department of Environment and Water Security. One of the ideas of your appointment was to reduce conflict of interest issues. Is it working?
At this stage, I would actually put it back to you. How many controversial decisions have I made that have actually made the media? And as a consequence, I would say, yes, it is working quite well.
Yep.
And I have to say that both the Minister and Joe are very scrupulous in the way in which I have that independent role. Obviously, I get support from the department, but I'm independent and I'm not scared to ask some of the hard questions. And so I'm working through that. So coming back to that, I suppose one of the other things you probably noticed that there were amendments to the Water Act, consequential amendments, which actually clarify what are the roles of the minister, what are the roles of the department, and what are the roles of the controller. So one of the things when I first started, we had to sit down and work through, was under the Water Act, I have a lot of opportunity to cause the department a lot of grief in terms of saying, I want science here or I want this program there and what have you, when in fact I have no financial authority. And so we've sorted all of that out, and that's why the consequential changes to the Act are in place.
Ready to put in another 12 months?
Absolutely. And just in finalising, I suppose one of the things, you know, you've asked the questions about the recovery of unused licence water and removal of water licence security levels. We're about to issue regulatory statements, which will go up on the department's website, and that will explain how they all operate and the background to it all.
Andrew, thanks for your time on the Country Hour and talking water with us.
Thank you.
That is Andrew Johnson, the NT's water controller. He's about 12 months into that role, and there's a lot going on. On the topic of water, the Territory Government has released its long-awaited draft water allocation plan for the Mataranka region. So this plan is comprised of three water management zones. So there is the North Mataranka, the South Mataranka, and Larrimah. The estimated sustainable yield for those three areas, according to the government, is a maximum of about 62,000 megalitres per year. Now, the public consultation period is now open. You've got until the 3rd of June to have your say, and you can do so via the government's Have Your Say website. On the show tomorrow, we'll be speaking to Amy Dysart, who is the Executive Director of NT Water Resources. There's quite a few questions about water coming through on the text line right now on 0487991057. I'll be putting these to Amy Dysart. So if you want me to ask more questions, keep sending them through on that text line 0487991057.
G'day, I'm Brad Inglis from Sturt Plain Station, south of Dunmara on the Stuart Highway, and you're listening to the NT Country Hour.
The Barkly Highway has been damaged by recent flooding, and there's a number of traffic restrictions still in place as we go to air this afternoon. Between Threeways and the Barkly Homestead, nothing heavier than 4.5 tonnes is allowed on that section of the Barkly Highway. The only vehicles permitted are high-clearance four-wheel drives, but even then there's directional closures in place. So if you are heading eastbound on the Barkly, you can only do so between 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock in the morning. If you're heading westbound, you can only do that between midday and 3 p.m. On the Country Hour yesterday, we heard from the member for Barkly, Steve Edgington, who says there's a number of major roads in the Territory that are in a shocking state.
Many places right across the Barkly at the moment, you know, we have roads closed, but some of the main roads, such as the Stuart Highway, for example, has suffered quite extensive damage over this wet season, you know, just driving up and back to Borroloola in the last week, certainly between Tennant Creek right up to the Highway Inn. There is quite a number of potholes, but a couple of big washouts as well. So just north of Three Ways, there's two floodways that have been washed out. And also around Renner Springs, there was significant damage, and probably about 80 kilometres north of Elliot, there was quite substantial damage to the road as well. So, look, contractors are out there. They're very busy at the moment trying to, you know, fill some of those potholes to make it safe for road users at the moment.
Steve Edgington on the program yesterday. So the Barkly Highway in particular. If you're over 4.5 tonnes, so all cattle trucks and road trains, they're not allowed on that section at the moment. We were hoping to have someone from the Department of Infrastructure on the Country Hour today. We've been told there's one key person who is in that region or heading to that region. So hopefully tomorrow we can bring you more information on exactly what damage has been done to the Barkly Highway. It is 12 to 1 and you are tuned into the Country Hour. If you're in the top end and own a fringe of penny tree or maybe some pawpaw plants, I wonder if you've noticed a problem this year. Has there been something attacking your fringe of pennies or your pawpaws? There's an exotic pest out there that's got a real hunger for this stuff. Up next, the Country Hour. We'll head out to try and find a few.
I'm Emily Hoffman, and I love chasing chunky skinks in the top end. And you are listening to the Country Hour.
Now, scattered around Darwin are a bunch of yellow, sticky bits of paper. They're hanging from trees. I wonder if you've seen them. They've been put there by the NT's Department of Industry, which is looking for a pest that is called papaya mealybug. Now, this is an exotic plant pest which was first found in Darwin in July of last year. It chews on frangipani trees and it can kill pawpaw plants. Dan Fitzgerald went out with entomologist Dr. Brian Thistleton to check one of the sticky traps hanging up in Darwin's CBD and to learn more about what's been done to combat this pest.
So we're down round from the Esplanade, just near the Anglican Cathedral. We've got a yellow sticky board which we've had hanging in a frangipani tree for quite a long time now. We look at it fortnightly. And this yellow sticky board, we use yellow sticky boards often for collecting insects. They're really good for things like aphids and psyllids. But in this case, we found that it's attractive to the parasitoid that's come in with the papaya mealybug, and we're trying to monitor the spread of that parasitoid.
And you've just taken this yellow sticky board off of this frangipani tree at a quick first glance. What can you see?
Quick first glance, there's a lot of insects on it. The parasitoids are actually very tiny, so we'll normally take this back to the lab and look at it with a under a microscope. We have got an example, a picture with us of a yellow sticky board from another area in Darwin, and we've circled all the parasitoids, and I think we've got up to 300 on a yellow sticky board at times. So the parasitoids are increasing in number. They're not everywhere yet, so these sticky boards allow us to track where they are.
And where else across Darwin and surrounds do you have these yellow sticky boards looking for the mealybug?
Well, we have them in a whole range of suburbs in Darwin. Everywhere we found the mealybug, and the mealybug is expanding. Mealybug has also been found in Palmerston, so we'll be getting traps out in Palmerston area too.
And what does that mean for people that it is seems to be moving around a bit.
Well, it will. I mean, it's got a range of hosts, but its main hosts are papaya, as its name suggests, frangipani and hibiscus, but also another number of more minor hosts. People will notice it. It will get onto the plants, and to begin with, you'll get quite a large infestation. If it goes like it's gone overseas, and in every other country with the parasitoid, this is what's happened, the populations will drop right back to very low. But you've got to go through this period when you have a bit of pain while the two get into equilibrium. And
for our audience, that parasitoid, what is a parasitoid and what does it do to the mealybug?
So a parasitoid, it's a tiny wasp that lives inside. It lays its eggs on the mealybug and lives inside the mealybug. It's very similar to the concept of a parasite, but in this case it's called a parasitoid because it actually kills the insect it comes through on. So the papaya mealybug originated in Mexico, Guatemala, Costa Rica, those areas in Central America. It got into USA in 1998, into Florida, and they were the people who did all the USDA did all the studies and found the parasitoid in Central America and introduced it into USA. Then it got into Southeast Asia, it got into Sri Lanka and India, the Philippines, Indonesia, Timor. And in each case, the parasitoid has been introduced and now it's no longer a problem. At one stage, it was heavily infesting all the frangipani in Bali, for instance, and now it's in low numbers. It got into the papaya mealybug got into Timor. We didn't need to put the parasitoid there because it came in naturally. Unfortunately, it's not fortunate we've got the mealybug, but when the mealybug came to Darwin, it did come with the parasitoid, so we don't have to do an introduction. It's here. We've just got to wait for it to build up.
Yeah, so the mealybug was first found in Australia, in Darwin, sort of late last year, and it looks like it's brought in this parasitoid with it, its own worst enemy.
That's right. It's brought the parasitoid in, which implies that it actually came in on plant material with the mealybug and the parasitoid in there, rather than as crawlers of the mealybug or whatever.
So in a best case scenario, this parasitoid might control the mealybug itself without you having to do too much.
Well, that's right. Eventually, it will control it. In the meantime, there are some things you can do. Sprays don't work very well because of the covering, the waxy covering on the mealybug. So normal insecticide sprays, they will give some control, but you've got to give double the rate and you've got to keep spraying. Oils like some of the oil sprays and the soap sprays do work. They work by smothering the mealybug and they won't kill the parasitoids, so that's good. So those are things that can be done. We're going to do an experiment. Now it's getting drier, probably after Easter. We found that one of the local ladybirds, called Cryptolemus, common name is mealybug ladybird, they actually love these things, and they've been effective overseas, and they're effective in Darwin. We've had trees that have been cleared by these things, and they're things that you can buy from biological supply houses, from Bugs for Bugs and places like that. So after Easter, when it's a bit drier, we're going to get some of those and release them to up the population of those while the parasitoid is getting underway.
That is Dr. Brian Thistleton, who's a principal entomologist at the Department of Industry, speaking to Dan Fitzgerald about this papaya mealybug. I wonder if it's been affecting your plants. On the text line 0487 99 1057, people sharing their experience with this pest. John at Astute Park says, Matt, not just the frangipanis and the papaya, chili bushes, hibiscus and other stuff too getting hit by this pest. Mark in Humpty Doo says, Matt, frangipanis all down McMillan's Road have been attacked. What is happening, mate? And a text here from Rob who says, I'm on a residential property in Rapid Creek. The stuff you're about to talk about is ravaging my papaya, hibiscus and frangipani. It is ruthless, says Rob this afternoon on 0487 99 1057. I actually might give you a call, Rob, and see if you can share more with our audience about what it looks like and and how your trees are faring. Is there a chance for them to bounce back? I was having a very quick chat to Brian Thistledon actually this morning because I have got a suspicion that the Rosella plants at my place are getting hit by this thing. I'm not sure, but my job this afternoon is to take some pictures of my Rosellas and send it through to the department.
Hi, I'm Jake Stringer. I'm the manager of Kidman Spring Station and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. In a moment, you'll get to meet an award-winning biosecurity sniffer dog. And we'll keep talking about papaya mealybug, this exotic pest that is chewing through frangipani trees, pawpaw plants, and plenty more in the top end, it would seem, judging by your text messages this afternoon on 0487991057. Marilyn, who is in Palmerston this afternoon, says, my wedge-leaf frangipani is being ravaged by mealybugs. Awful, says Marilyn. And Davo in Alloa says, please, please send me some of those ladybugs. I've lost 8 papaya trees and all of my frangipanis look shocking, says Davo this afternoon. Yeah, that was quite interesting, wasn't it? Dr. Brian Thistledon talking about a plan to get ladybugs to work. This was what he told us just a moment ago.
We're going to do an experiment. Now it's getting drier, probably after Easter. We found that one of the local ladybirds called Cryptolemus, common name is mealybug ladybird, they actually love these things, and they've been effective overseas and they're effective in Darwin. We've had trees that have been cleared by these things. And they are things that you can buy from biological supply houses, from Bugs for Bugs and places like that. So after Easter, when it's a bit drier, we're going to get some of those and release them to up the population of those while the parasitoid is getting underway.
There you go. Release the ladybugs. I like the sound of that. Ladybugs joining the war against the exotic papaya mealybug. Gee, I'll take some as well. As I mentioned, I've got a suspicion that my Rosella plants have been hit by this pest. I've got to take some photos and send it to the department to confirm, but I wonder if anyone else listening this afternoon has noticed problems with their Rosellas or anything else that you feel this pest is getting stuck into. Let's go to the Weather Bureau now. Sally Cutter is there this afternoon. Sally, any problems in your backyard? Any frangipani trees in your neighbourhood?
The frangipani on the nature shelf doesn't look too bad, though it has dropped a few leaves, but I don't know whether that's more seasonal. I think my croton might have not be happy, though, but it's not in a great position. So, but it survived this long in a not great position, but yeah. I don't know whether that's...
I mean, this pest is that pest only rocked up into Darwin in July of last year. So yeah. I don't think the old crotons are on the list of potential hosts, but I could be wrong. But certainly papaya is a big one for it, frangipanis, but other people are reporting problems on their chili bushes, hibiscus.
And, well, see, my croton would be over 20 years old, so it might be age as much as anything else in that case.
Yep. All righty then, weather. A little bit more rain out in the VRD in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, there's been a little bit of rain around. We're still seeing a little bit of rain through the Barkly area, and as well as over the top end, and also in the VRD. There's been mainly coastal. Old Delamere's had 1.8 millimetres since 9 o'clock. If we're looking to 9 o'clock this morning, Mount Nankar 33.4 at 42. Bullow River's 18 millimetres, Keep River 13.5, Douglas River 15 millimetres. So there's certainly still been some rain out that way. And Delamere's had 8 millimetres as well. So, yeah, there is still rain out there, and we're probably going to see the top end continuing to see those showers and occasional storms, but the southern parts are going to, or they're cooling down. The Alice and Eulara is about 5 degrees, 3 to 5 degrees cooler than this time yesterday, as we've got this cool change, but windy, coming, making its way north.
Yes, your colleague Billy Lynch, dropped this big headline yesterday on us that we were set to experience a significant change, a real taste, if you like, of the dry season. What can you tell us about this southeasterly surge, how far it will push and what it will do?
Well, through central Australia, it's definitely dropped those temperatures down and it's going to be windy for a couple of days. So Barkly is going to see the conditions that we usually see when we get these southeasterly winds. So we've got that good Barkly breeze going on, probably through until the weekend. And the surge does move further north. It's probably mainly going to ease off the showers and storms, not totally clear them, and it's not going to be the dry, like a dry season, but compared with what we have been having, once we get into the weekend or even late this week, it's going to feel dry in comparison with what we've been having over the last few months.
Yeah, and it could potentially be a bit short-lived though, is that right? There's another...
It's the trough. We are keeping an eye on the trough that's offshore, well offshore. Mm-hmm. But the ridge does weaken a little bit, but it looks like there might be another one coming in to reinforce it again early next week. So, but we're still going to get those easterly winds, which unfortunately with slightly drier conditions, clearer skies, means that the western parts of the top end are going to get up into the mid-30s. So that's probably the drawback of it. But It's going to hang around a while, but it's not going to totally weaken off, is probably what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, okay. Do you think Northern Australia could rustle up a cyclone in April?
We're looking at one off the Kimberley coast, or well off the Kimberley coast, and so just to the west of Timor. So that's probably the one that we're keeping a really close eye on. We are also keeping an eye on that trough up to the north of us, and at the moment, the focus or the main concern is that one over sort of WA. But we've got the trough over water. It is still cyclone season. There is the potential for a low to develop in it. So we're going to be keeping a very close eye on it.
Mm-hmm. All right, then. Anything else we need to be aware of?
No, just if you're heading out on the water, it's a little bit windy, 15 to 20 knots, even up getting up to 25 on Thursday in the Gulf of Carpentaria. West coast, the winds are picking up there as well as that surge moves northwards. So if you're heading out on the water, check the forecast before you go.
Yep.
If you're over land, south of the probably about Elliott Way, we're going to see some relatively clear skies but windy conditions. And over the top end, we're going to see the showers and storms ease off just a little bit but not totally clear.
Thanks for your time this afternoon.
That's okay.
Sally Cutter there at the Weather Bureau, and just repeating some of the news about our main roads in the Northern Territory. They have been battered by this wet season. There's damage to sections along the Stuart Highway and also the Victoria Highway, so just be careful and stay up to date via the Road Report NT website. And as for the Barkly Highway, well, between Three Ways and the Barkly Homestead, it is closed for vehicles over 4.5 tonnes. It's really only high-clearance four-wheel drives that are allowed on that section. And even then, if you're heading eastbound, you're only allowed to do so between 6 and 9 o'clock in the morning. Westbound traffic's allowed between midday and 3 p.m. A maximum of 4.5 tonnes on that section of the Barkly. We are hopeful of speaking to someone from the Department of Infrastructure on tomorrow's Country Hour.
Time for the family road trip.
98.
The big prawn.
Ah, yes.
99.
The big mosquito.
It's a real one.
And 100.
Easy.
The big listen app.
Of course.
The ABC Listen app has a big array of road trip ready podcasts, radio, audiobooks, music and sport. Something for everyone.
I guess it has to be big to fit in all those podcasts.
Aww. For a big selection of audio entertainment.
It really does.
Listen big. Download the free ABC Listen app today.
A black Labrador has just won a Service Dog Award at the Sydney Royal Easter Show. The six-year-old, this is impressive, made 739 interceptions at Sydney's International Airport just last year. That is a record amongst the ranks of biosecurity sniffer dogs. What a dog. Her name is Vespa and her handler is Perry Corrette.
Vesper is one of our biosecurity detector dogs, and she primarily works at Sydney Airport and Mail Centre, and she just has a massive personality. She loves what she does, and she makes every day enjoyable for me.
A black Labrador?
Black Labrador, yes.
And how old is she?
Vesper is 7 years old.
Oh, wow. So she's been on it for quite a while, yeah?
Yeah, she's experienced. She's a pro at her job by now.
So what are the kinds of things that Vesper's detected?
Yes, sir. Our dogs are trained to find a variety of different target odours, predominantly things sort of like food items or plant material, animal-based products. Plants, seeds, bulbs.
It's surprising meat. What comes in.
Yeah, there's a massive quantity of things that they're looking for.
Because I saw a note there about her detecting foot and mouth disease. So that's come in on a product somewhere, yeah?
So foot and mouth disease can be carried in a range of commodities. In particular, our dogs are looking for products like meat or dairy that have a risk of carrying this virus within them.
But that's one, you know, a disease that if it got out into the Australian herd could shut down the whole beef industry. That could be a massive, massive problem. And she's picked up other things as well, or other products that have had disease that could threaten our industry as well. So just talk to me about what's her daily routine.
A day at work for Vespa. She arrives in the morning. She's always ready to go. And then she has a busy day screening passengers at the airport. We like to sneak in a little bit of a play and a pat and a bit of a treat here and there in between her busy work. But she loves what she does. She's always eager to go. And then she chuffs off in the afternoon for a bit of a snooze at the kennels. All right. And a bit of a pat.
So the average day would go for like an 8 or 10 hour day with her?
Her average day, she's would be at work for around 5 or so hours.
Right.
Yeah.
And how much longer has she got? Like at 7, she could do a few more still?
Yeah, so Vespa will be due to retire soon. So she's probably got about 12 more months of work.
It's not much longer to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's our major weapon in biosecurity, though. I can't afford to let her go just in 4 months.
Yeah, she's doing well. She still loves what she does. She's always excited to come to work. So I think it'll be a bit of a shock for her when she goes into retirement.
What happens in retirement for biosecurity dogs?
So our detector dogs are rehomed in a loving family once they retire. Generally, that is with one of their former handlers. And I certainly have a spot on my couch ready for Vespa. So
she's coming to you. Is that decided yet?
Oh, that's my plan anyway.
And in terms of the work with the dogs, like how significant are they from a biosecurity perspective, do you reckon?
Yeah, our dogs have an incredible impact. They're such a diverse tool for us. They have the ability to be mobile and they can detect things that many of our other systems don't have the reach for. So our dogs are able to be deployed across a variety of different settings, which is part of what makes them so valuable.
Mm. How many are there, do you know, in the service?
I believe in Sydney at the moment we have about 24 dogs working for us, although it is a national program, so there are many more working across the country.
Yeah.
In the works at the moment, they're recruiting around 20 new detector dogs and handlers to help facilitate the screening of incoming loads of passengers and mail across all different ports in Australia.
Yeah. And what is it about Labradors, do you think, that makes them good detector dogs?
Well, a Labrador is always a bit of a people pleaser, so they're keen to do the job, but they just want to do it to please their human. They also have an incredible nose. They've been bred for their nose and their detection abilities. They're very sociable creatures as well, so it makes them great for the airports where they're around people all of the time.
So in the cargo side, would they be working on ships or inspecting containers in terminals?
Yeah, so in cargo, the detector dogs have more of an open search sequence, so they can search on containers and areas like that. Searching for a variety of different pests and diseases, including brown marmorated stink bug, which can come in on those sorts of means.
Is she the first dog to compete in this way at a show? Like, it's kind of funny to think of those of biosecurity dogs involved in the show itself.
Yeah, I believe that she is our first dog to receive such an award, so it's a wonderful recognition of all of the work that service dogs as well as our detector dogs do and the training that goes into getting them up to scratch and the important work they do to help protect Australia's ecosystems.
That is Perry Currett, who works as a dog handler for the Federal Department of Agriculture. Well done. Well done to Vespa, the Black Labrador. 739 interceptions in just 1 year at the Sydney International Airport. That is good work there by Vespa. Now, on the topic of biosecurity, the federal government's controversial biosecurity levy It was passed in Parliament last week, but only Labor MPs voted in favour of it. So the government's bill won 74 votes to 67, with the Coalition, Green and Independent MPs flagging concerns and voting no. Independent MP Dr. Helen Haynes said there is no guarantee that this new charge on farmers will actually go to biosecurity measures. So the bill looks set to face plenty of scrutiny when it eventually heads to the Senate.
G'day, I'm Jermaine.
G'day, I'm Caleb.
And we're from Territory Bees. We're out here in Darwin's rural area attending to some hives, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
And we've been talking about the pest, the exotic pest papaya mealybug on the Country Hour today, and hearing your experiences. I've got a text here from James in Karama who says, my frangipani seems to have black stuff all over the leaves, which then falls into the pool and makes an absolute mess. What could it be? Is the question James is asking. It could well be this papaya mealybug, James. And someone has sent in a few pictures. And I tell you what, one of them, you know, has a similar look to what I'm experiencing with my Rosella plants. And Gil. Thanks, Gil. Gil says, these are a frangipani bush known as Everlasting Love. Some look as though they're sprouting new growth. The good man who was just on your show now, I hope he's right that they'll survive once the ladybugs or the parasitoid get working. Thought you might like to see some samples. Thank you, Gil. Thank you very much. And someone here, after hearing about bringing in the ladybugs to help fight the war, John here says, let's hope there are no unintended consequences with these ladybugs, a.k.a. the cane toad. Oh, let's... Surely not, John. Surely not. Now, the NT Rural Women's Award will be announced this week, and there are four wonderful nominees this year, which we will be featuring on the Country Hour over the coming days. So the first nominee is Raylene Brown from Kungus Kancook in Central Australia. Raylene was nominated for her work with women on country, harvesting bush foods and developing micro enterprises within the Indigenous bush foods industry. But of course, as you know, if you've been listening to the Country Hour over the years, Raylene does many, many other things. She had a catch-up with our reporter, Victoria Ellis.
I'm Raylene Brown, and I've been running a small business in Mabantua here, Alice Springs, for the last 25 years. Kungas Can Cook. A lot of local people know me. I don't actually have my catering business anymore, but I'm still working really hard in the bush foods industry space.
And you have been nominated as a 2024 finalist for the Rural Women's Awards. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's so exciting.
And you have done a lot of work in the bush foods space. You've touched on it only slightly just there with your introduction. But one of the things that you were specifically nominated for was your work with Women on Country, working and learning how to make micro enterprises with bush foods. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I can't take credit for all the hard work that those women have been doing out there for over 30 years, providing wild harvested seeds from the desert, things like the akajita, the bush tomato, and also our wonderful array of different wattle seeds that they've been harvesting. It's seasonal harvesting. And, you know, the women are so wonderful and resilient in the fact that there's not been a time since I've been involved that there hasn't been a harvest off country. And that's without infrastructure, that's without all the things that they probably would do really well with. But it's, for me, they already are in business and trading well before I came along. So, yeah.
What do you actually do? Can you describe what the process is like and what your involvement is?
Well, it really started when we opened up our little, opened up our catering business here in Alice Springs, and myself and Gina Smith, who was my ex-partner, we really wanted to, growing up on bush tucker ourselves, we wanted to have bush tucker on our menu. And back then people were going, what? What are you going to cook? Like, what is there to eat around here? A lot of the locals, you know, didn't realise that we're actually surrounded by all these beautiful edible seeds and berries and fruits, and they were thinking that we're going to serve witchetty grubs or something like that. But it was about, you know, bringing these bush foods in a way that people wouldn't be afraid to try them. So really infusing them into our menu and getting people used to the flavour, because it's like when you're introducing another food from another country, really. That's what it's been like. Like I've come from way over the ocean, I'm bringing this new food here, but it's here and it's ancient and it's our people have been, sustained them for many thousands of years. And so that was really like for me, it's an education of our local community, but now it's further than that. It's reaching out right across Australia around the story has been shared. So for me now, as the industry has grown, it's as though where the original product was coming from, the women are not visible in our industry. They're, and not kind of me, for me, they need to be valued for not only their hard work and their wonderful way of sharing the knowledge and sharing it with others. I really want to make sure that they're not left out of the growth of this industry, because from other workshops that I've done on country with projects for the Northern Territory Government, they are keen to be a part of this, and they want their next generation to be a part of this, creating, like you said, micro enterprises, and future jobs out on country, taking and maintaining, caring for country, also maintaining that the cultural protocols and stories and that go along with that. So that's the story that I heard from the women over and over and over again. It's just not like about an enterprise. It's also about the sharing and education of the next generation. So really I'm wanting to bring that story forward and look for support to make that happen, and other things that they may need, that they may want, because you know, this was probably 5 or 6 years ago now. How are women feeling right now about their participation in this industry? Is there still the eagerness to be a part of it? Do they feel like really left alone out there, you know, because at the end of the day, I'm here and I'm engaging with them and they all know me. They come in and they bring their product in. And they talk to me about what things are looking like out on country, whether they think it's going to be a good season or where's all the rain. We might not get much bush tomato. These are the conversations that I have, and that's why I made an effort to seek funding in the past to go out and be on country with them, to go out digging up bush tomatoes, to have a look around on country, to see what other issues that are facing the women out there, even around fire management and fire control.
That is Raylene Brown from Kungus Ken Cook, who is one of the Rural Women's Award nominees, speaking to Victoria Ellis. We'll be catching up with the other nominees throughout this week on the Country Hour. But now it's time to head to the sale yards of all the latest prices out of Roma. Here's David Friend.
With Easter concluded and the possibility of more rain, Roma agents yarded 1,230 head. All the regular processes were active. However, not all feedlotters present, with restockers showing interest. Prices improved slightly in most categories. Lightweight yearling steers under 200 kilos showed least improvement, selling to 14 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 200 to 280 kilos improved and sold from 312 to 482 to average 422 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos also improved and made to 408 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 330 to 400 kilos to restockers sold from 358 to 370, with the over 400 kilos selling to 328 cents a kilo. Yearling heifers 200 to 280 kilos made to 330. The two score cows 400 to 520 kilos made from 160 to 212, with the three score cows to 240. A run of preg tested Brahman cow sold from 250 cents. The best of the heavyweight bulls to 258. This has been David from the National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for that, David. Remember last week I brought you a story about bird flu being found in some dairy cows over in the US. It had popped up in some herds around Texas and Kansas. Well, over in America this afternoon, multiple news agencies are now reporting that a person has been diagnosed with bird flu. Not good. Not good. This has been confirmed by the Texas Department of State Health Services. I'm sure you can read more about that if you like via the internet. CBS, ABC News in America, NBC, they're all reporting it. There's a bit of breaking news for you this afternoon. Now, tomorrow, let's talk about the brand new draft water allocation plan for the Mataranka region. That'll be on the Country Hour tomorrow. Keep it rural.